So here we have a nice artist's conception of a star overfilling its Roche lobe and accreting onto a white dwarf, which is significant because I used to be on a basketball team called the Roche Lobetrotters. So, right. See, physicists don't get that joke whenever I tell it. All right, so let's get serious and talk about the Chandrasekhar limit. I think we're all familiar with that, theoretically, you shouldn't be able to get a white dwarf more than 1.4 solar masses. Okay, but remember that this is derived for the non-rotating case of a white dwarf. And, you know, I know there are some naysayers out there, so I've actually dug into the archives and found some new evidence, incontrovertible evidence of that Superchandra exists. So, I think even Wolfgang would, you know, he can't deny that. Yeah. What's that? Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right. So here's, I don't want to say much about the legacy survey. Mark Sullivan will be saying a lot more about that later, but this is just a little piece of one of our one square degree fields. This is a little piece of one of our 36 chips. And right down here is our favorite supernova. It's this. Here is the after picture, and here's the, well, before, or where the supernova's not there at least. Here's where we put a slit down to get a spectrum, and here's the HST picture, and we have the redshift of this little thing, which is the host, and then this bigger spiral as well, and they're both at the same redshift of 0.244. We fit models to the host galaxy photometry, UGRIZ photometry, and we get that it's about 10 to the 9 solar masses, this little tiny thing. So it's something like 3 times the LMC or something like that. And the star formation rate is 1.26 solar masses per year. So now, formally, if you just take the, you know, how long does it take you to get this much mass out of this kind of star formation rate, if you assume a constant star formation rate, that gives you an age of 0.7 gigayears, although, of course, that's incredibly unreliable. But it does make the point that it's a young host. It's probably one of the most extreme hosts we've seen for a type 1A. Now, we got the spectrum from Keck, that's this line, and it looks just like a 1A, so here's 94D. You know, you can't really question, I mean, I think it's quite solidly a 1A. Here's silicon, here's sulfur, here's, you know, it's basically got everything that you expect, but there are some differences. First, you'll see that, well, it does look different than 91T, so it looks like there are more intermediate mass elements than we're used to seeing in these overly bright supernovae, and it has very low velocities. The silicon is around 8,000 kilometers per second at maximum. I'll show that in a second, but you can just see that in the fact that you can split here calcium 2 and silicon 2, which are normally joined together in most type 1As. The other thing that's strange is that there's this absorption right here, which we identify as carbon 2. After maximum light, you just never see that. You occasionally see it before maximum in some supernovae, but almost never at maximum, which means that there's carbon deep down inside the ejecta. Okay, well, that's our identification anyway from SINO. Now, this is a SINO match here, but it does point you to other carbon 2 features, which we don't really see, although the spectrum is pretty noisy. But what gave me confidence that that was actually carbon 2 is that in supernova 06D, which the supernova factory has, you see all of these lines, and SINO doesn't get the strengths exactly right. So I think that is actually carbon 2. Okay, so the other crazy thing is that there's almost no calcium 2, even though there's plenty of silicon and sulfur, which is a little strange. So in fact, if we sort of make the equivalent width of silicon and over the equivalent width of calcium versus the equivalent width of calcium, you can see that O3D3BB is up here all by itself in parameter space. 91T is almost the opposite in a way. It had little of both, But the other interesting thing is that 98AQ is the closest supernova in terms of these elements, and it was the only other one with carbon at maximum light. I don't know what that means, but something. So theorists, please tell me. Okay, so here's silicon velocity. Here's what kind of outlier it is from normal type 1As. Okay, it's quite low. And here's the light curve. Okay, now, this was from the early days of the LEGSI survey, so the light curve coverage is pretty sparse. But the important thing here is that R and I band is what we're using in the fit, and we do have a data point really close to maximum for R band, which we can then turn into a V band with a K correction. We find M sub V of minus 19.94, which puts it at the brightest, essentially the brightest supernova type 1A ever. The stretch is 1.13, so it's a high stretch. So it's quite an outlier from the distribution of here's the low Z supernovae from that we used in Astier. It's 2.2 times the median luminosity of a 1A, which immediately, if you think a normal 1A is 0.6 solar masses of material, that gives you 1.3 solar masses. But I'll do a more precise calculation here in a second. Okay, well, before we get to that, just to review, the energy that you get to unbind the star, the kinetic energy, comes from fusing all of the elements, you know, promptly. But then, of course, the light curve is powered by the nickel decay later. So, you know, in the most dense regions, you burn up to these iron peak elements. In less dense regions, you get intermediate mass elements. And depending on how much of this you make, if you make more nickel, you get more energy for the fusion, and you should have higher velocities, and then you can get a brighter light curve as well. So again, nickel decay powers, you know, 1A light curves. If you actually converted a 1A into nickels, it would be worth $12 million. So that's like 12 with 10 to the 30, okay, or 14 no million Canadian. So. All right, but now this one is a $25 million supernova. So, you know, all right. So here's how we get this nickel mass. Remember Arnett's rule: luminosity at maximum is proportional to the spontaneous energy deposition by radioactive decay. But you know, in the classical picture, you just assume that those two things are equal, but it may not be equal. So alpha is the ratio of the radioactivity luminosity, bolometric to radioactivity luminosity. And here, instead of 1, we'll use 1.2. That gives you a more conservative estimate on the mass of nickel. And that's what people seem to find in the literature. Here's the calculation. Basically, we get 1.3 solar masses of nickel. Now, if 40% of the supernova is non-nickel 56, that gives you 2.1 solar masses for the white dwarf. Admittedly, we don't know this number, but we know that there must be some iron peak elements that aren't nickel 56. There's got to be intermediate mass elements, and we think there's carbon as well. So, all right, I should not have called this a limit here. This is one of from Alexei Kokolov's models of, if you just detonate the whole thing, you get this amount of nickel 56, and the other stuff is iron peak elements that aren't nickel 56. If you change the parameters, you can, as I understand it, you can move this around. So, not technically a limit. But here we see BB is way outside of the distribution of other type 1As. So, as I alluded to, if you have all of this nickel, you should get high kinetic energies if the Chandrasekhar mass model is the correct one. So here is the nickel mass that we derive using the formula I just showed earlier. And here's the velocity using the data at maximum light. Now, this is from Benetti. So then if you project those to 40 days, here's what it looks like. And here are the predictions from the kinetic energy. Remember, the kinetic energy, the nuclear energy that you generated in the fusion, minus the binding energy. So, of course, in the Chandra model, the binding energy is the same for all of these. So that means more nickel, you should get these kinds of lines. Now, here's the carbon fraction. Of course, if you don't burn everything, you'll get less energy. So that you'll go down. This is a tenth, two-tenths, three-tenths of a fraction of carbon. So here's BB. It doesn't really fit into this picture. But now if you go to Super Chandra you get higher binding energy, according to Yoon and Langer, and you get these models here. And you know, BB roughly, again, fits in with this 2.1 solar mass white dwarf picture. This is an independent argument from the luminosity, but it seems to match the same mass.
So the spectrum you have is from day 4.
No. Sorry, the spectrum is from day 2. But the issue here is that you need to get sort of the kinetic energy tells you only something about the middle of the light curve, essentially. This is not a precise, this 40 days, it could be anything. You don't really know what observable velocity maps to the velocity that you would get from kinetic energy, but that's, you need something sort of right in the middle. Yeah, Wolfgang. Sorry? You know, what can I say? That's the light curve fits don't seem to vary by that much. I mean, you could tell that there was a downturn in the light curve. It is a strange object, but okay. I mean, sure. It's day 2. What can I say? All right. It looks like a day 2 spectrum as well. All right. What's that? Day 2 after max. Yeah. All right. So if you play around with those fits, I don't think you can. You know, it's clearly here. I'll just put the light curve back up. All right, so, you know, it was rising here, it's falling there, you know, it's right around max. Okay, you might be able to play with a little bit, but not very much. Anyway, this kind of outlier, you know, it's clearly not, we're not wrong by the amount that you'd need to be to bring this in agreement with these kinds of things. Okay, now, some possible explanations. If you like the double degenerate picture, the merger of two massive white dwarfs can in principle produce a superchamber product. The single degenerate model, as I said, rapid rotation, according to Yoon and Langer, could give you a two solar mass white dwarf, or maybe even higher, but this does require differential rotation, and you know, Stan doesn't like that, so he can comment. Just for completeness, I'm throwing in this Livio and Rees paper that they published trying to explain 2002 IC, saying that, well, it could be a white dwarf merging with an AGB star during the common envelope phase, but then I don't like that because you have to have hydrogen around, so we don't see that in our spectrum. Okay, so can we get a constraint from the superchamber picture on the age? Well, let's figure out what mass white dwarf does a star make, and this is from Ferrario et al. We've seen another plot like this at the conference, but basically for initial final mass relation here, if we want to see the minimum merger time in the double degenerate picture, take say 0.7 solar masses, white dwarfs and merge them, then you need some initial mass around 3 solar masses, and that happens here at a young age. Okay, so this is the minimum merger time for the double degenerate picture. And if you at early, this is just to show you that at early times, you have to have a superchandra. The products have to be superchandra. Now I don't know the details of what goes on in the merger, but and then if you just put BB's host age on here, you know, it's within this picture. Of course, you could get it at later times as well. But the point is, early times in a merger scenario, you have to have something that's superchandra, at least to start with. Who knows what happens? Okay, now again, this is not very reliable, but it's just to show you that it's consistent. Okay, so this is just another way of saying that, but in the single degenerate model, the same thing, you can expect the same thing, that in a young population, you have more massive white dwarfs, and you have more massive secondaries, so it's easier to get superchandra. Okay, so one thing we want to know is how rare are these things? You can see that there's this group here, there's a big gap. This thing's a big outlier, but there is a class of objects here that all are in spirals, that all have high-ish nickel masses and low-ish velocities. So it could they be related to O3D3BB? I'm not sure. Could they be superchandra but at a lower level? Well, it's possible, but there's no real there's no real information. Okay. Now this is pretty speculative, but why should younger environments produce brighter supernovae? We do see this. As you go to strongly star-forming galaxies, you get higher average stretches, which means higher brightnesses. In the Chandra model, there's no reason to expect this, but in a super Chandra model, you would expect it. Okay. So, since my title had a question mark in it, given to me by Lars, I thought, well, I should try to explain some ideas that other people have to get it under the Chandrasekhar mass. Okay, you could have interaction, asphericity, or extreme departures from Arnett's rule, so let's go through those. Interaction. 2002 IC was about as luminous as this supernova, but people think it's because, if it's a 1A, it's because of interaction with a circumstellar medium. But in that case, you have features like 91T, but diluted because of some continuum, is the theory, and then you have narrow hydrogen. So that doesn't seem to be what's going on in O3D3BB. So, you know, you need something like an interaction fairy that, you know, produces some kind of interaction, but then doesn't leave any trace of it. So, you know, there's no hydrogen in the spectrum, for example, and the features don't look either like 91T or diluted. And remember that there are actual oddities in the spectrum here that are different than most 1As. So it is the case that there is something spectrally different going on in this supernova. It's not just a straight normal supernova interacting. Another idea is off-center nickel blob. And this is a recent paper by Wolfgang et al. And this isn't a simulation. It's just taking a big blob of nickel in the center, 0.9 solar masses, and moving it over near your line of sight here. And so this is a very extreme model. If you're looking at the right angle here, you can get about the right brightness, but it requires pretty extreme assumptions, extreme opacity, and it would not reproduce the spectrum or the velocity. And you can see this is a tiny little bit of other stuff here. And so I encourage you to talk to them about their model if you want the real details. So this is just the beginning, though. You know, I think they're going to produce more detailed models that will actually be more serious about spectra and stuff like that. Okay. Another constraint on the asphericity is that if you want to use a model like that to explain, if it's not just a one-off and it needs to explain other supernova, then this supernova, this extreme, are like something like 1 in 300, maybe 1 in 1,000. We've never seen another one like it. So that would imply a small solid angle for increased luminosity. So that, not like normal clumps, that would have to be something like a jet or a beam, which would have increased, not decreased, velocities. And it wouldn't explain why brighter supernovae are found in young populations all the time. Another thing is extreme departures from Arnett's rule. People think it's good to about 20%, but it has to be wrong by 70% to get 0.9 solar masses of nickel in this case. Like I said, we already essentially assumed it's wrong by 20% to get our numbers here. If you used alpha equals 1, you'd get a nickel mass of 1.6 solar masses. So, and again, you have this other problem that the more nickel you have, you would tend to decrease alpha since some of the gamma rays will escape and not make the supernova brighter. Okay, so to conclude, this thing had a MV of minus 19.94, which is the brightest supernova ever observed. With Arnett's law, you get 1.3 solar masses of nickel. If 40% of the elements are non-nickel 56, that gives you a 2.1 solar mass white dwarf. The low velocity is opposite of the expectation you had from the simple Chandra picture, but it's consistent with super Chandra. The young population is consistent. The spectrum seems to have more intermediate mass elements than 91T, and it has also unburned material. So every expectation that we have from this simple super Chandra picture has been met so far. Of course, it would be nice to have a more sophisticated theoretical calculation. And I think that is the simplest explanation. It doesn't follow the stretch luminosity relationship. And we did throw it out of the cosmology, but you know, this does make you wonder if there are less extreme examples that might not follow the relationship in the cosmology. And you know, what's the real rate of these things, and are there ones at a slightly lower level? A grad student in Toronto is working with me to look into that, Bryce Kroll. So hopefully we'll have an update in the future. Thanks.
questions, Alex?
Get Alex first. Hand it
over. Andy, I just wanted to ask about the host.
Mm-hmm.
You said all those galaxies are at the same redshift, and though it's possible that the supernova was in that little dinky thing,
mm-hmm.
which looks like a Magellanic Irregular or something like that,
yep.
if that thing weren't there, you would have just said it was in that bigger, brighter guy next door.
Yep.
So it could well have been in the bigger, brighter guy next door, and not necessarily be representative of the population of that little tiny Magellanic host, a putative host.
You're saying that maybe there is some, stars that are assigned to the big galaxy
sure.
that are just,
of course,
underneath
the halo of that galaxy.
Sure, it could be.
If there hadn't been that little thing there, you wouldn't have said, oh, this thing is really far away from this galaxy, so it's not associated.
Yeah,
right.
but by the same token, I mean, a lot of these ones that are on the edges of these galaxies could just be from these little
galaxies. Yeah, I know.
Galaxies.
I'm just saying, I'm not saying it's not in that host. I'm just saying that there's also a reasonable possibility that it's not in that little tiny host.
But both are at the same redshift, though. Is the
yeah, that's
thing.
True.
So it doesn't change the
right.
conclusions about.
I agree. I just wanted to point out it's not necessarily in that little tiny host. Yeah.
Well, just a remark. I think the model, it was kind of a fun game, to be honest. But the model is not so extreme as you imply. Because this morning we heard from Ken that he advocates a model with 3,000 kilometers per second offset of the bulk of this stable iron in a supernova. They seem to measure it in the infrared data. We just assume 1,000, which is moderate in that respect. So it's not really so extreme. And actually this picture you showed is kind of a bit misleading because it shows velocity distribution and not really in mass and in density and so on. So I think, and the other point is if you just missed your epoch by a couple of days, 2 or 3 days, then 8,000 kilometers per second is not such a low velocity anymore. Then you find many supernovae that have these kind of velocities.
No, that's not true for 8,000 kilometers per second. If you look at Benetti's the V dot like that he gets for both supernovae, it's 50 kilometers per second per day. Okay,
uh-huh.
So the delta V for an average supernova. Okay, so that means we have to get it wrong by a couple of weeks to get it to a normal velocity.
We had other examples in our sample, for instance, where I checked actually after getting that the velocities, day five or so in the silicon were around with reasonable nickel masses around 8,000 or so. And anyway, but it's as I said, was to caution you, because having a lot of mass doesn't mean that you get a lot of nickel. You have
to transform
that mass into nickel, and that's it's damned hard to transform whatever you had there to such a huge amount of nickel, and none of the models ever gave that.
But in your model, it pretty much requires there being high velocity because you have to put the silicon outside of the nickel,
yeah.
and you need higher velocity. So what I don't like about it is that it's like the offset nickel is like one epicycle to save the model, and then to add another. Which is, what's the velocity doing? It's like adding another epicycle. So, I like the simpler explanation.
But the simple explanation is not all that simple.
So, could be. Phil?
I think you make a good case for a Superchandra model. I'm still puzzled, why is this system so unique? I mean, your last point there. I mean, why haven't other systems been found that fill the gap to the more normal systems?
Well, we were talking about this, I think, at lunch. David mentioned somebody's work, I can't remember who it was, about the, these big white dwarfs, say, or whatever it takes to make these, are pretty rare. And so, it could just be that we
small
almost
number
never...
statistics?
What's that? Sorry?
Small number statistics?
Yeah, well, it could just be that these things are extremely rare. Now, another thing is that, remember, this is from this tiny, tiny little host, and at low redshift, we get most of our things from Alex, right? And they have a targeted survey, which is these big galaxies in, say, RC3 catalog or something like that. So it could be that you would miss some of these little tiny things. At the high redshift universe, the star formation rate is a factor of 10 higher at a redshift of 1.5 than it is locally. And so these oddballs will be a lot more common at high redshift. So we may find more of these in supernova legacy survey and things like that.
Okay, we'll go, Roseanne.
I wanted to ask about the comment you made about white dwarfs in young galaxies, because as you know, when you're going to have a merger, there has to be some prior epoch or epochs of interaction between the components, which can cut off the evolution of one or both of the stars so that they each have lower white dwarf mass than you'd expect just based on where they come from in the luminosity distribution or the mass distribution. So I just wanted to ask you about that and ask your comments about that.
Yeah, it is true that when I was going through the argument for getting a young system, I was talking about what we know from sort of single evolution, not binary evolution, and that could completely throw a monkey wrench into that kind of thing. But I think the general picture is probably still true. People here are better experts than me that in a younger population you're going to have the bigger white dwarfs and so on. Yep.
The great thing about the surveys like the SNLS is that you get this unbiased rates. So can you give us an estimate of the rate of these per SNU or?
We haven't done those numbers because it does require a little bit different calculation than what we normally do. I mean, there's a big point here is that we fit all of our light curves with 1A models to prioritize them for follow-up spectroscopy, because if we didn't do that, we'd only be like 50% efficient at Keck or something like that, because we'd be following so many core collapse supernovae. So it's quite possible that we are, these things are there, but we're not following them up because of our prioritization scheme. So that's pretty uncertain. It is kind of telling that we got this in the early days of the supernova survey before we had this scheme in place. So.
Well, you have this estimate of a high mass.
Yeah.
And what would be really interesting would be if you took all the supernovae and used exactly the same rules and you made a distribution of the masses that are found by doing the same thing that you did here.
Right.
Have you looked at that and then varied the parameters? And
So Bryce has started doing that, and there is still, I don't want to announce official results yet, but basically there's still this gap between this supernova and the rest of our supernovae. So
I would argue the rate for this kind of objects is very low, and I'm also a little bit concerned why we don't see them in the nearby universe, because if they are super Chandra, they're really bright. You can argue we missed all of them in the dwarf galaxies. Mm. The KIT search is a targeted search, but there are other searches like the Texas survey. There are many other surveys targeted randomly. So we just don't see them in the nearby universe. So why is that?
You can make the same argument about, say, 2002 IC or some of these other things that we've only started discovering recently when people have started going to these untargeted searches, essentially, right? So. Why do we keep finding these new types of 1As? I don't know.
The number of supernovae is much larger now than it was in the past.
That's
so
true.
It may or may not have to do with the nature of the search. It could just have to do with the size of the sample.
That's true.
Go one more if you want to go.
Just to be a devil's advocate, if I look at the numbers there, you said our net rule is good to about 20%, so maybe it's not 1.3 masses of nickel, but one. And then add to that 40%, it's 1.4.
No, like I said, it has to be alpha of 1.7 to get, down to say 0.9. Okay, so yeah, I mean, well, if you wanna do that, then fine. But then how do you explain these other things like low velocity and so on? I mean. What I need is a theorist to give us a really good model either way,
Okay, well, on that comment, we'll move on. Our next speaker is David Branch on